Coming up, a message from the pulpit of Bethel Primitive Baptist Church in Calabash, North Carolina, by Elder Michael Goins. For information about Bethel Church, please visit our website at bethelpbc.us.
This morning I've opened my Bible to the third chapter of the book of Exodus. Let's read beginning in the first verse through verse 14, Exodus chapter 3. Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert, and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush, and he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here am I. And he said, Draw not nigh hither. Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people, which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. And I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of the land unto a good land and a large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey, unto the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel is come unto me, and I have also seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppress them. Come now therefore, and I will send thee unto Pharaoh, that thou mayest bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. And Moses said unto God, Who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh, and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt? And he said, Certainly I will be with thee. And this shall be a token unto thee that I have sent thee, when thou hast brought forth the people out of Egypt, ye shall serve God upon this mountain. And Moses said unto God, Behold, when I come unto the children of Israel, and shall say unto them, The God of your fathers hath sent me unto you. And they shall say unto me, What is his name? What shall I say unto them? And God said unto Moses, I am that I am. And he said, Thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am hath sent me unto you. After introducing a study entitled Knowing God for the past 2 weeks, today we want to come to the specifics. And the first thing we need to consider as we think about the character of God is the theme of the being of God. You see that thought in this title, I am that I am. This sacred, ineffable name of God speaks of his being. Now, to say that God has being is simply to say that he is a living God. In contrast to idols, which are objects that men have made that can be seen and touched and handled, but yet there's no life there, our God is a living God. I think of the 115th Psalm, where the psalmist says, Not unto us, O Lord, not unto us, but unto thy name give glory, for thy mercy and for thy truth's sake. Wherefore should the heathen say, Where is now their God? And I love his response, Our God is in the heavens. He hath done whatsoever he hath pleased. Then immediately, in contrast to this sovereign God, this high God who's in the heavens, who works his will, who does what he pleases, in contrast, he says, Their idols are the works of men's hands. They have eyes, but they see not. They have mouths, but they speak not. Hands, but they handle not. Ears, but they hear not. He says, They that make them are like unto them. That is, they're lifeless. Because the idols that men make are like a child's little baby doll. It has all of the appearances of life. It has ears, eyes, hair, a head, a body, but yet there's no life there. And that's what an idol is. In contrast to the gods that men make, the God who's the true and the living God who made all things is a God who has the power of being within himself. Listen to Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 10. The Lord says through the prophet that the idolaters, people who worship an idol, are altogether brutish and foolish. Brutish means like a brute or a beast, an animal. They're just acting according to their baser, lower nature. They are altogether brutish and foolish. The stock, that is the stock of the tree that they've carved out into an idol, is a doctrine of vanities. The word vanity means emptiness. There's nothing to it, in other words. They bring silver plates from Tarshish and gold from Uphaz. He says they deck their idol that they fabricated with purple and blue. They're all the work of cunning men. Listen now to verse 10. But the Lord is the true God. That word Lord, if you'll look in your King James Bible, is written in all caps. Jeremiah 10:10. It's the word Jehovah, which came from the title I am that I am. He says, but the Lord, Jehovah, is the true God. He is the living God and an everlasting King. At his wrath, the earth shall tremble, and the nations shall not be able to abide his indignation. Think about that. You've heard this expression that he's the true and the living God over and over again. If you're like me, when you hear something frequently, it tends to lose its impact. I want you to think about it. He's the true God. And he's the living God, because no other God is alive, right? He has the power of life. He's living. That was true 10,000 years ago. It was true before time began. It's true today. It will be true forever. He's the living God. He's the source, therefore, of all other life, for he himself has life within him. He's the great I am. I love 1 Thessalonians 1:9 when Paul speaks to the church at Thessalonica and he says, you turned to God from idols to serve the living and the true God. Over and again in the Bible, our God's called the living God, the true God. And that's what we're saying when we say that God has being. Now, the life of Moses, who is the key figure in Exodus chapter 3 and further in the book of Exodus, can be divided, someone said, into three periods of 40 years each. He lived a total of 120 years. And you can divide his life, that 120 years, into three periods of 40 years. The first 40 years, Moses learned that he was somebody. He was reared in Pharaoh's house, raised with access to all the learning of the Egyptians. He received the finest education. He's probably next in line to the throne of Egypt as the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter. Moses, in the first 40 years, had all of the wealth, all of the privileges of royalty. He learned he was somebody. The second 40 years he spent in the backside of the desert, he learned that he was nobody. He lived as a Bedouin in the desert, and he kept his father-in-law Jethro's sheep. And then the last 40 years, which begin with this narrative I've read you in Exodus 3, when he's 80 years old, the last 40 years of his life, he learned that God was everything. And that's what we see before us now. At this event that is recorded here, it's an event of strategic importance. Exodus 3 records the burning bush episode, when God appears to him out of the midst of the bush, and then God gives a verbal revelation of himself, and he says, my name is I am that I am. May I suggest that this was a turning point again in Moses' life? It was a formative experience that would set the pace for the last 40 years of his life, in which he is called to lead the nation. Moses was not made leader of the Hebrew nation by popular vote or by the Electoral College. That's not how he became the leader. It wasn't man who put him in this position. It was God. It's God who chose him. God who called him. God chose Moses as the deliverer of the Jewish people out of Egypt. I love verse 7 of our text. The Lord said, I've surely seen the affliction of my people, which are in Egypt, and I've heard their cries by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. And I'm come down to deliver them. God's going to deliver them. After 400 years in the iron furnace, God is going to liberate the Jews from Egyptian bondage. How's he going to do it? He's going to use this fellow who has learned that he's nobody, who's learned that he's just a face in the crowd. He was reared thinking, I'm going to be the Pharaoh one day. Now he's learned, I'm just a sheep herder. I live out here in the backside of the desert. And one day he got up just like he did on every other day for the past 40 years. And he said, well, it's time to go water the sheep, time to go find some place for them to graze. The routines of life have set in, and he doesn't suspect what's about to happen. But I'll tell you what happened was a turning point. And by the way, you may get up one morning, just like you have every other morning for the past several years, the past many months, and it may just seem that you're just going through the motions, operating in routine, and suddenly God breaks through. For this is the living God who can and does reveal himself and appear to his people. I love that old hymn we sing sometimes. Sometimes a light surprises the Christian while he sings. It is the Lord who rises with healing in his wings. You ever had that experience? Sitting there and just singing. Somebody says, okay, next, number 254, and you turn to that. Somebody else says, number 316, you turn to that. And suddenly someone selects a hymn, and it's as if the heavens have opened. And what seemed like routine, monotony, just going through the motions, now suddenly you are in communion with God. Sometimes a light surprises the Christian while he sings. It's happened to me. It happened to me this morning. Because our God's a living God. Our God's real. He's not a little statue we keep on the mantle that somebody says has religious significance, but he can't actually do anything. Our God is the not I was, not I will be, not I exist in your imagination. He's the great I am who has the power of being in and of himself. So in the two parts to this passage that I've read, God appears to Moses in the burning bush. And then he speaks to Moses out of that bush and says, my name is I am. In both the visible appearance and the verbal revelation, the same lesson is taught. And what is that lesson? It is a lesson concerning the eternally present self-existence and being of God. Now, verse 14 says, I am that I am. You say, what does that mean, I am? If a fifth grade student in the classroom wrote a sentence, I am, period, most educators would say you need to embellish on that. You've got a subject and you've got a verb, a form of be, right? The subject is I, and the verb is the form of be, am, period. You would say, well, you need to finish the predicate. I am what? I am tired. I am strong. I am intelligent. I am rich. I am what? You need to finish it. But God says it's already finished. I am. And then, lest we should think that there's something needs to be added, he said that, I am. And you talk about circular logic. And God has the right to use circular logic. You get to the end of that sentence, it leads you right back to the first, right? It's like a circle. I am what? I am that I am. You say, Brother Mike, it sounds interesting, but it just seems really abstract to me. Well, if we think the name is abstract, the burning bush, the concrete reality of this theophany, which is a visible manifestation of the presence of God, is going to grab your attention because the same lesson is taught in the name, I am, that's taught in this symbol of the burning bush, which is on fire, but it's not consumed. And that's what God is like. Now, we're asking the question in this study, what is God like? Who is God? And somebody says, well, I like to think about God as maybe a dolphin in the ocean. Or I like to think about God as some kind of mystical energy. God has revealed himself already in his word and told us what he's like. And the first thing we learn is that God has existed from all eternity past. He still exists today, the same. He hasn't changed one iota, and he will exist forever. He is still the great I am. Now, can you say that about yourself? You know what I would say about myself? My name would not be I am. My name would be I was. I'm a has been. My theme song is the old gray mare, she ain't what she used to be. I'm just a shadow of my former self. And most of us can say that. Now, many of you little ones, you young people, you would say, not I was, I'm a has been. You would say, I hope to be. I will be, I have potential. One day I hope to be a surgeon, an astronaut, a school teacher, a mother, a banker, an electrician. Well, you say, I have these dreams. This is what I hope to be. I'm in progress toward that goal. But most of us, or many of us this morning, I would say, could say, my name is I was. God's name when Moses lived was Moses, my name is I am. His name when Jesus came to this earth was still I am. And his name today is still I am. In fact, listen to this interesting verse, John 8:58. Now try to wrap your mind around this. Before Abraham was, past tense, I am, present tense. You say, well, that just means he is preexistent to Abraham. It means more than that. He could have said, before Abraham was, I was, and that would say, I existed before Abraham. But he says, before Abraham was, I still am. And you might scratch your head and say, Brother Goins, I don't understand. You're really wading in some deep water this morning. Well, this is essentially philosophical, that's for sure. I admit that, and we're dealing in abstract concepts. But again, remember that burning bush, because though it's expending energy, it's not itself expended. God says, before Abraham was, I still am. He's talking about the fact that he's not only preexistent to Abraham, but he's eternally present in his preexistence. He still is before Abraham. Think of a sheet of paper that extends to infinity. That would be eternity. Then on that sheet of paper, draw a short line to represent time. As the line begins and ends on that infinite expanse, so time began in God and it will end in God. This is the thought of the eternity and the self-existence of God. When God says, I am, he's simply saying, I exist. Now, the New Testament equivalent is Hebrews 11:6. Without faith, it is impossible to please God, for he that cometh to God must believe what? That he is. He is and I am are synonyms. They're equal, right? Can you see that? You have a subject, you have a verb, a form of be. He is the same as I am. And it's the same as Moses recorded in the one psalm that he wrote contained in the canon of Old Testament scripture, Psalm 90. And if you'll look at the caption in the Good King James Bible above Psalm 90, you'll see that it says a prayer of Moses. And it's interesting that the same man who had this burning bush experience wrote this psalm, and he says this, from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. Now I want to ask you, do you see the similarity between I am, he is, thou art? What these three sentences have in common is each uses the most basic and rudimentary type of verbs, the form of be. Now, I know you kids are on summer break and you don't want to think about English grammar, but I'm going to prepare you to go back to school here in another month or so by asking you to define what a verb is. Do you remember what a verb is? You say it's an action word. He ran. It's something you're doing. He ran, she read, mom cooked supper. That's a verb. But there's another category of verbs besides action words, right? Do you know what they are? Forms of be. Is, was, were, are, am. Forms of be. You say, Brother Mike, what does it mean to be? Well, the opposite of it is not to be, right? In the one line from Shakespeare that I could repeat right offhand, And you probably know it too. It's from Hamlet. Hamlet said, to be or what? Not to be. That is the question. I remember the first time as a high school junior sitting in literature class when I ran across that quote, and my teacher had an entire hour and a half class to discuss the meaning of that. I thought it was the most foolish waste of time that I'd ever had. To be or not to be, I scratched my head and thought, what in the world could that possibly mean? Think about it. Hamlet is saying the real question is, should I continue to live, though this life is fraught with pain and toil? Or should I cease to live and risk the unknown that comes with death? Which one is worse? To be, to live, to exist, or not to be? So you see, this form of be or being concerns the idea of existence. So when God says, I am, he's saying God is everything that is essential to existence in and of himself, and it is a verb that's in the present tense, as we've already stated. Now, that's not true of us. You and I are creatures of change. The philosopher Heraclitus is the man who came up with the observation that probably you've heard, you can't step into the same river twice. You ever heard that? If you put your left foot into a creek or a riverbed, by the time you get your right foot in the river that your left foot entered, it's already moved on. Probably some grains of sand on this bed of that river have moved position, and you are a few seconds older. You're not the same person. You can't step into the same river twice. What he's saying is that there's nothing about us that is so universally true across the board as the fact that we all change. Are you the same person you were yesterday, last year, 10 years ago? I'm older. I'm grayer. I'm on the wane. You see, the law of entropy is taking a toll in your life and in mine. Isn't that right, dear friends? We all change. I'm telling you, there's only one being in the universe who is eternally present, who never changes. He's the great I am. Our God is expending energy, but not himself consumed or expended. He's like that bush that burned with fire, but he's not any less God today than he was yesterday. You talk about an eternal flame, that's God's being. He never changes. He's always the same. He's always and forever the source of all other being. Everything else that exists in this world derives its being from him. Acts 17:28 on Mars Hill, Paul said, in him we live and move and have our what? Being. Now, you've heard of human beings. You've heard of spiritual beings like angels or demons, angelic beings. But there's also a supreme being. And the supreme being is the only one really who has the right to call himself a being. The rest of us are creatures who were made, right? We have existence, but we have existence because, first and foremost, he exists. And perhaps you asked this morning, Brother Mike, can you prove that God exists? Yes, by this flower arrangement on the table. By the fact that you're sitting here this morning, the fact that I'm standing here. You see, logic demands that something or someone must exist before anything else exists. If anything exists, you, me, this glass of water, then someone or something must exist before us that has the power of being in himself. There's an old expression, ex nihilo nihil fit, which means out of nothing comes what? Nothing. Let's talk about your bank account. Let's say you're broke. I mean, flat broke. You have how much in there? Not 1 cent, not a dime, not a nickel. You have nothing. How long are you going to have to look at that bank account with nothing in it before you get something in it. How long are you going to have to look at it? Forever. And that'll even be too short. It's not going to happen. Because out of nothing comes nothing. That's a principle of logic. In fact, all science, true science, is based on that principle that an object cannot simply self-generate or self-create. Now you say, well, what about God? Where did God come from? You know, in all of the years that I've been trying to pastor and preach the gospel, the single most frequent question that has been posed to me by little children, theological question, is some form of the question, where did God come from? When was God born? What is the origin of God? And I always try to answer, God didn't have a beginning because he's eternal. He's without beginning, without ending. God has always been from everlasting to everlasting. Thou art God. Interestingly, that word everlasting in Psalm 90 verse 2 is the Hebrew word olam, which means the vanishing point. He means as far backward as you can look that way to the vanishing point, to the horizon, where you can't see any further. You know, the horizon is the limit of your vision. When the sky meets the land, you can't see any further. It's the vanishing, it's the point at which your vision vanishes. From the horizon that way to the vanishing point this way. God is God, and God is the same, and he is the source of everything else that exists. If there was ever a time that absolutely nothing existed, then nothing would exist today. Let's just be real honest this morning. This rostrum is real. You're real. I'm real. This glass of water's real. Where did it come from? Ultimately speaking, if there is no eternally existent God who has the power of being within himself, you say, well, it all came from a rock hurtling through space millions and millions of years ago that collided with another rock. You had the Big Bang, and it all exploded into being. Exploded into what? Non-life exploded into life? That doesn't make good nonsense. The living God is the only true God. His name is I Am, and he has the power of being within himself. He's self-existent. I'm not self-existent. I'm derived from the being of God. You're derived. We came after the fact. We owe our existence to something and someone else. You say, well, I owe mine to my parents. Well, where'd your parents come from? You trace it back far enough, you're going to have to trace it all the way back to the God who is eternal. All life comes from him. There was a time when you and I were not, and when the universe was not, but there was never a time when God was not. He's self-existent. This name, I Am, not only teaches us that God has the power of being within himself, but it teaches us that the God of the burning bush is an eternal God. Again, you say, Brother Mike, I can't understand that. I know what you're talking about. We have no point of reference. A.W. Tozer said that we learn by using what we already know as a bridge to pass to the unknown. And the fact is that there's no point of reference in my experience, in yours, in the world of sight and sense with which we're familiar to compare this idea with, that God has no beginning, no ending, but something in the universe must be eternal. Probably the best way to describe it is the way that my daughter Ashley described it when she was about 6 years old, when she had asked me the question, Daddy, where did God come from? And I said, he didn't come from anywhere, for he's always been. He's the first great cause, the uncreated cause of all effects that exist. And she said, as she thought about it for a minute, she finally said, Daddy, when I try to think about that, my mind just goes blank. And I thought, she just expressed the sensation that I feel when I try to think about the fact that God is eternal, but I never knew how to put it into words. My mental circuit breakers trip. I have a power overload. My brain does not compute the idea of permanence because all I know is impermanence. But You know, the Bible teaches that God is eternal. Deuteronomy 33:27 says, "The eternal God is thy refuge." By the way, this is Moses' farewell message to the children of Israel. Deuteronomy 33:27, about seven verses after this, it says, "And Moses died." These are his last words. And what does he feel compelled to say in his last words to the children of Israel? "The eternal God is your refuge. And underneath are the everlasting arms." He knew these Bedouins in the desert who had wandered for 40 years in the wilderness were about to go into the land of Canaan, but yet Moses himself was not permitted to go in. He knew that they had found a home, a dwelling place, a refuge in God throughout all of these previous generations. Psalm 90, "Thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations." And he reminds them, as you think about the future of your life, I want you to remember that the eternal God, the God who never changes, the God who's always been, the God who's the same yesterday, today, and forever, is your haven of rest. He's your safe harbor. You can find asylum in the eternity of God. I want you to think about that this morning. I'm not eternal. I'm getting older. My mind's getting duller. My voice is getting weaker. My body's breaking down, yours is too. We change, we experience decay, it's all around us. Change and decay and all around I see. You say, "Brother Mike, I feel like nothing is stable, nothing is certain, nothing is sure." Here's your refuge, child of grace. The eternal God is your refuge. The God who is unlike anything else which you've ever encountered. He's like a bush that burns with fire, but it's not any less. The longer you look at it, it's still the same height, still the same shape. It's continuing to burn. You say, "The fuel, why isn't the fuel consuming?" It's the bush is continuing to exist, but it's burning with fire, but it's not itself consumed. So God has been active, again, expending energy, but not himself expended or consumed. He's the great I am. He's immortal. 1 Timothy 1:17 says, "Now unto the King, eternal, immortal." The word immortal means not subject to change or decay. And he's the only one who has immortality in and of himself. 1 Timothy 6:17 says, "Who only hath immortality, dwelling in the light, to which no man can approach, whom no man hath seen or can see." We've learned this morning that the God of the burning bush is a self-existent God who has the power of being within himself. We've learned that the God of the burning bush is an eternal God without beginning, without ending, and therefore he's changeless. He's independent. He's not determined by anything except himself. I want to close with this. The God of the burning bush is a God of grace. There's an interesting verse in Deuteronomy 33, verse 16. That's the same chapter of Moses' farewell address. He's about to die. Same chapter where we read in verse 27, "The eternal God is your refuge, is thy refuge." Listen to him in Deuteronomy chapter 33, verse 16, as he tells Joseph, the tribe of Joseph, "For the precious things of the earth and the fullness thereof, and for the goodwill of him that dwelt in the bush." Now, what do you think he has reference to in this expression as Moses refers to the goodwill of the one who dwelt in the bush? He's harking back to this experience at the beginning of his journey in Exodus chapter 3, when he turned 80 years old, the last 40 years of his life, when he had this integral role to play as the leader of the nation of Israel, the deliverer of the Jews from Egypt. Moses is thinking back to this experience when he was called to service. He's walking along with his sheep, herding them just like every other day, and suddenly he saw this sight that caught his attention. He must have done a double take. He stopped and looked at it a second, and he drew nigh, but as he got closer, he heard a voice out of the bush saying, "Don't come any closer. Come not nigh hither, but remove thy shoes from off thy feet, for the ground whereon thou standest is holy ground." May I say, wherever the presence of God is, that place is sacred. You say, "There's nothing sacred about this building." If God's here, this is a sacred space. There's nothing sacred about this hour of worship. If God is here and it's devoted to his glory, this is sacred time. It's holy. Anytime you're in the presence of God, you're on holy, holy, not common, not mundane, not ordinary, not regular ground. You're on holy ground. You're in a sacred place. Anytime God is present, my friends, and I hope you know He's here today. He's here today. And Moses, thinking back on this experience now as he's dying, speaks of the goodwill. Now, we've talked about the self-existence of the God in the bush. We've talked about the eternality of the God who dwells in the bush. Moses speaks of the grace or the favor, the goodwill of him that dwelt in the bush. The God of the burning bush is a God of grace. He's a God who enters into covenant with his people. That's what the language of verse 6 means. I am the God of thy father, Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. That's the language of covenant. He's entered into a relationship. He's the God of compassion and mercy, as verses 7 and 8 indicate. He sees the affliction of his people. He hears their cry. He knows their sorrows, and he comes down in his mercy and grace to deliver them. A God of grace. By the way, this name, I Am, the God who has the power of being within himself, the God who never had a beginning, who will never have an ending, and the God of goodwill and favor and kindness and grace, all of this culminates in the person of Jesus Christ, who said before Abraham was, notice he takes the name to himself, I Am. What does he mean? He means I'm God. I'm God. If there's ever a claim to divinity, it's no clearer anywhere else than it is right here before Abraham was, I Am. You say, well, Brother Mike, I just wish I could embellish on that a little bit. Well, we'll look at the Gospel of John, where 7 times he uses that title, I Am, and he adds a predicate to it. I am the bread of life. Are you hungry? He's your food. I am the living water. Are you thirsty? Do you need refreshment? Jesus is the source of that. Are you prone to death and decay? I am the resurrection and the life. Are you a lost sheep? I am the good shepherd who gives my life for the sheep. Are you full of ignorance and easily distracted? Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Are you in the darkness of confusion and ignorance? Jesus says, I am the light of the world. He adds meaning, he adds ideas that are pregnant with significance to this wonderful divine title, I Am, in the Gospel of John. This ineffable name contains the promise of God's kindness and sympathy and help. And as such, my beloved, it gives weak and transitory and sinful people like us great hope and comfort and strength for our lives both now and forever. How should you and I respond to this God? Take your shoes off your feet. Be reverent. Be humble before Him. For He's the true God. He's the living God. Be careful in His presence and hold Him in great respect and esteem because He's God and we're not. That's how you should respond. And secondly, by confessing Him. As some of our Baptist ancestors in Wales confessed him in the first article of the 1655 Midland Confession of Faith. Listen to this. We believe and profess that there's only one true God, who is our God, who is eternal, almighty, unchangeable, infinite, and incomprehensible, who is a spirit, watch this, having his being within himself and giving being to every other creature. He does what he wills in heaven and earth, working all things according to the counsel of his own will. That's the Welsh Baptist confession of the being of God. Your being, my being, our existence is wrapped up completely in the God who is the source of all life and the source of every blessing that you will ever need. His name is the great I Am. If you haven't confessed him publicly through baptism, and united with the people who believe in this God, we bid you to come this morning as we stand to sing an appropriate hymn. God.
Come, 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 every blessing to my heart to
Grace Alone Radio is an affiliate of Sovereign Grace Publications. For the past 30-plus years, Sovereign Grace Publications has published and distributed books from some of the best contemporary authors among Primitive Baptists. Our goal has been to make sound and substantive biblical literature accessible to the rank-and-file believer. Currently, we have over 25 titles available, ranging from New Testament expositions to Christian apologetics to biblical studies to daily devotionals and even poetry. For a complete list of our titles, visit the bookstore at sovgrace.net. That's S-O-V as in victory, G-R-A-C-E.net.